Listen, everyone makes messes. It's just a part of life. And the bigger you live, the bigger the mess, if you know what I mean. That's why you need Fabuloso. With twice the active cleaning ingredients, it just completely takes the drama out of any mess. It smells great while you clean. The only way to describe it is the scent of passion. And once you're done cleaning, it lasts so long. You know, if you make a mess, you can get your home dramatically clean with Fabuloso. No worries.
Living life, there are so many opportunities to develop your ability to handle criticism.
I can't think of a single review that could like completely make you or completely break you.
Not asking what works and what doesn't work. Instead, ask yourself the question, what does the story want to become?
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Tutor Ramble episode. I am one of your hosts, Austin.
And I'm your other host, Richard.
Today, we have a panel, a round table of sorts, with another three indie authors. We have Michael R. Miller, Adrian M. Gibson, and Keith Entrante. Very interesante. Welcome, guys. I'm going to give a quick overview, then introduce all of you officially, because today, Rich, we're talking about how to handle criticism.
A well-used topic, because I don't know how. It sounds like bad advice of just ignore it, turn off the PC. We're going to go deeper than that, but that's the best advice I have. I'm hoping these three gentlemen have better advice than me.
They should, because it's one thing getting a hate comment or, oh, I didn't like your opinion on a video you did. Okay, we put some effort into a video versus someone tearing apart your life's journey.
I've been spending months to years on this project.
My baby.
And, you know, I think it's bad. That hurts. That hurts deeply. I get it. That's a different beast.
Maybe we'll think twice when giving criticism. Okay, guys. I'll introduce in the order we got the books here. We have Michael R. Miller, who wrote, this is his first book, Ascended in the Songs of Chaos. And he also has another trilogy, the Dragon's Blade trilogy. He has a lot to say on this topic. And the reason I have these three here, so I have Michael, who has some popularity with these books and has a bunch of reviews on Goodreads. He can definitely attest to a lot of getting a bunch of 5-star reviews and then some 1-star reviews, and just in that general, how does he handle the feedback, the criticism, and so forth. And we have Adrian M. Gibson, who wrote Mushroom Blues. Right there, great, great plug. Adrian knows. See, Michael, you got to get better at that. You
got
to get better.
I'm a podcaster too, so. Michael's got like a whole backdrop.
Yeah, there you go. Point to
there
it.
Come on.
And you Keith see just Keith sneakily just grabs.
Prepping ahead of time.
But Adrian, very happy to have you on, because did you write this book about fungi, which is so cool and unique, but you are in the finalist for the SPFBO, which is the Sci-Fi Fantasy Self-Published Book Awards.
Correction,
that Mark Warren
just wins. Fantasy, sir.
Just fantasy. Fantasy. Thank you. Thank you for the correction. Yes.
SPSFC is the sci-fi one.
Yes. Thank you very much. And you are a finalist in there. So hundreds are in and reviewed, and you're in the final 10, and we'll see if you win. So very excited about that. And you'll have a lot to say on the awards and feedback as well. And then lastly, but not least, we have Keith Entrante with Let Them Whimper. For this book, it's humorfold. People refer to it very Douglas Adams style. And you got the Forward Reviews 2023 Book of the Year Award for humor. So thank you all three for coming on. That was a mouthful.
That was a lot.
That was a lot. We're not used to five people on here. So I want to let you guys take the stage. And in the order we introduced you, I guess we could start talking about this and just let it flow from there. So Michael, do you want to jump in, talk about this, and then feel free to interrupt us at any point going forward here.
Just take the whole topic in a moment, but yeah.
Just do it.
I like how Richard starts the conversation off by, just don't watch. So Abuchi was saying, yeah, just shut it off. Just shut off, Chris. Close the browser, unsubscribe. That's a big question. I've been at this for 8 years. And so initially it's very raw. I'm not going to say you become numb to it, but yeah, see, over time, you just become a little numb to it and you stop taking it quite so personally. You will learn over time to, as Rich was saying, like, this is your baby. And after a while, you're like, okay, they're not my babies. They are just books. I've worked in them and they're attacking the book. They're not quite attacking me. Sometimes when they do attack you, that's, that does hurt. But Ultimately, you just have to, if you're going to read the negative ones, just try to be a bit dispassionate, a bit disconnected, and find the places where there is actually a little bit of genuine feedback. And if things are building up and there's a consensus forming, then you can take that on board if you want. But, you know, people are just saying, I didn't like X thing, but you love that X thing and that's really important to you, then, you know, you don't have to listen to that. You're going to find your rhythm with this over time. I think you should look at the reviews. I don't really buy into people saying you should never look at your reviews, because I don't think that's, well, it's not very grown up. Like, it's not very adult. You have to sometimes encounter hard things in life. And if you don't develop a thick skin, you're not going to last very long in this. There's always going to be some bad ones. But what you'll find if you're looking carefully is you'll notice that people are picking up the weaknesses that you may yourself know in your heart is there. And so you can take those on board, right? You're like, oh, I know that bit of the book was a little weak, or I know that character didn't quite work, and that feedback is coming through. You're like, okay, I knew that. It's fine. That's actually not a bad thing, because you know how to improve already. You're just seeing that reinforced. And so I would encourage you to look at stuff, engage with it. If you need to have a tantrum, do that privately to someone via DMs or to, you know, don't
take it to Twitter. Don't go online with that.
Yeah, take that. Bottle it all in until you get so angry.
Well, Michael, do you know what the turning point for you was when you developed the thicker skin? Is there a difference between early on when you first released the book, where did every review matter and did it hurt worse? Is there something in the sense of the more criticism, the more feedback there is, the less individual critiques and comments matter? Or did it just,
yeah,
what happened, no, definitely, to harden your skin?
Just the volume. I mean, if you get enough hits, you know, you get a little stronger. But yeah, you know, 8 years ago when it was Dragon's Blade Book One, you know, and that did not come storming out of the gates, right? So any review that came in felt like it really mattered. And so if those were a little negative, you just, because that was the only one you saw for 2 weeks, so you kind of obsess over it, right? And you know, as things go on, as things take off a little bit, reviews start coming in so frequently. We'll talk about Amazon reviews, I guess, and right, like customer reviews, reader reviews. They start to come in so frequently, you sort of can't read them all, you can't keep up with them. So it's a kind of volume thing. And then experience, you're used to it, and then it just wears off. It isn't, as time goes on, it just isn't so personal. But that first book, it's going to hurt. It is going to sting. But that's totally normal.
And you've all gone through the process of when you're writing your book, you want beta readers. You want someone to go, hey, what do you think about that? And get the feedback. Adrian, Keith, too, as well. Do you guys have thoughts on what's the difference between good feedback of, hey, here's how to improve it, versus after the book's done and people are just saying what they think and feel and criticism? Is that the difference? And how do you all feel in that writing process? Because obviously you need some type of feedback when you're writing.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to beta readers and that kind of thing, there's a difference between a beta reader and the kind of feedback that they're giving you in a review and the kind of criticisms that it's delivering. When it's a beta reader, you are specifically choosing that person with the intention of them going through your book and picking out things that aren't necessarily working for them with the desire to help you improve that thing. A review is not, hey, I'm going to review this book and hope that it's going to improve this book. The book exists as it is. There's no changing that book unless that author decides, like, down the line, I'm going to release a revised edition or something like that. But with beta readers, usually they're very trusted people whose voices and opinions you're very familiar with, and you know that they're going to be able to deliver constructive criticism for your book as part of the process. And even then, you never really know, like, which things are going to click with which beta readers. You know, Mike, you were saying, like, there are certain things in reviews that you'll see, like, okay, this is a common theme. Someone's criticizing this thing over and over again in different reviews. Beta readers tend to do the same thing, where they'll pick up weak spots. Not necessarily, like, this paragraph is weak, this sentence is weak. It's more like the general flow or punch of this chapter isn't working. I know what you're trying to do, but it's not landing right. And so those are the things that you can do just because it's a part of that process that is still the process. It allows you to take that feedback and figure out your own way of solving this potential problem. Whereas criticism that comes from a reader or reviewer afterwards, it's like this thing exists in a different state. It went from the state of creation to the state of product. And so this person is reviewing it as a product that they potentially invested money in, that they heard things about from other people. And maybe it met their expectations or exceeded their expectations, but maybe it fell completely flat of their expectations. And I think it's very, very easy for us as consumers, humans as consumers, to very nonchalantly criticize other things that people create without thinking about the process that went into that thing. You know, it's like,
okay,
like
first, stop looking at us like that. Okay, and now continue.
Stop criticizing us, guys. Just gonna put out a ban on all reviews.
Movies have embargoes. You don't get books, but movies have felt like review embargoes. I don't see books with that.
I have seen
a difference between.
I have seen a couple times that people like will say, "Here's my ARC. Send it out to a bunch of ARC readers who are gonna review it." And they'll say like they've actually put an embargo on like reviews below a certain number, which to me was like, okay, that's interesting. Yeah.
It seems to me there's the difference between a beta reader is supposed to be for the author and then a reviewer is for fellow readers. It's like they're
can I frame it this way? Like a beta reader is part of the team. And a reader or a viewer is part of the audience who's watching the game.
I'm very curious too, because I have for all three of you at some point during this talk, I pulled up a 5-star and 1-star review from your Goodreads or your books, except Keith, who you only have 3-star and ups on your book. Now you do have less reviews than them. Yeah. You do have less reviews, but you're striking almost 100.
I've got 40 reviews total, so the hate train is wide open. Anyone watching, I need my first hater.
You could be the first. Read it.
Yeah, and then he's gonna sulk about it for 2 weeks.
Like, the one I've ascended, Austin, that you need to find is the one that I got on Goodreads. It was a 1-star before the book even released. And it was from a very ardent, very upset vegan that the dragons ate a lot of meat. And this is quite a review all the way down. And I don't even know how they got hold of it, but there you go.
That's impressive. You should have put that on the back of the book. Like, that's dedicated, you know.
The one star that I appreciate the most is the person who hated on the book for having a glossary at the beginning.
I was complimenting that before the recording started.
Yeah, he was literally going like, hey, so, I love this glossary at the beginning. Right, it's great.
Right. Yeah, it's but simple. I feel like if you don't like the glossary, just flip through to the story.
You don't have to read that one.
Right, right.
If you don't want to read the author's preface, you don't have to. Like, you can start at just chapter one. That's fine.
Exactly.
Now, Keith, what's that like for you where you haven't really gotten negative feedback, or has it all been pretty positive?
So I got to say, first of all, it's surreal to be here. It feels like the show is happening to me and I'm like getting early access to just watch it all. And so if I get really silent, it's because I think I'm just watching you guys. I've gotten negative feedback. So I had the unique experience of writing Let Them Whimper during my MFA program. So my beta readers were my fellow cohort. And I was actually just like super confident from the first chapter. They only got to read like the first 2 chapters or so. And then I was working with like my advisor on the rest of the book. But one of those, one of the people in my cohort actually, you know, used to be friends with Stephen King in the 80s. Like he had this book. Like he was big in New York at the time, and then some life stuff happened and he kind of lost everything. So when he was giving me feedback, I was paying closer attention to this guy who's like, you know, was at the top of the literary world, than anyone else's. So like, you know, like it's about picking and choosing whose ideas do you kind of respect, like, or you vibe with more, that they understand more what you're trying to do, to pay closer attention to those kind of beta readers than the ones that just don't, like, they don't get it. There's another situation that I had where, like, one of the people I submitted reviews to, I think it was Blue Ink or something, and like for a professional review, and they sent back a message saying, like, we are actually, like, the reader that we assigned, it's just kind of like, we're not going to review it. Do you want your money back? And this was an interesting situation because I suspect that they're like, they acknowledge that the book is, like, well done, but that reviewer just didn't like it. So they couldn't.
Could they not have found a different reviewer for it?
They did. So they went and found a different reviewer. And instead, I was like, no, just, like, find someone else. I'll wait. I'm patient. I'm teaching middle school. Like, I got all year, man. Like, it's cool. And the reviewer that they found ended up really enjoying the book. So, like, all of my professional reviews, like Kirkus, Blue Ink, and Forward, they all are positive. And then I don't have any negative reviews on Goodreads or Amazon for people yet, but I'm ready for it. Like I said, you can't hurt my feelings actually, because I worked on my craft, like, for 13 years. I wrote, like, multiple books, so many short stories and novellas and stuff. So I came to a place where I feel like I did my best, and I know that, like, you can't hurt me now because, like, this, I stand by every decision I made in this book. I stand by every single word. So you can't, no matter what you say, it won't hurt my feelings, but you're totally entitled to whatever opinion you may have.
Does it also, like, develop a thick skin from being a middle school teacher and, like, doing an MFA? You
have to have something. Yeah.
I feel like life.
Much harder things to deal with in a day.
Yeah. It's just like, I was a tattoo artist for 6.5 years, and, like, my thick skin was, like, hardened to rock during that process. We're like, out of every creative endeavor I've ever done, I'm like, yeah, if I did a shitty tattoo versus if I wrote a book that someone one-starred, I'm like, I don't care what you think versus, right, like, if I messed up somebody's tattoo that was a permanent thing on their skin. So I feel like life is not just, like, being a writer, not just doing your craft, but, like, living life. There's so many opportunities to develop your ability to handle criticism.
Earning the respect of preteens too is, like you guys alluded to, it's the hardest thing I'll ever do. And the other thing is too, like, this may be the only book I ever actually do. Like, I'm totally making peace with that fact, because, like, when I write, it's full body, it's full everything. It takes over my life, it takes over my relationships. If this is the one piece of art that I put out there, it's like, I'm cool with it. Like, and I'll just, you know, move on. But I'll market it till I don't draw breath anymore. But
Is there something to be said about criticism really hurts when you yourself think there's a nugget of truth into it? Where, Keith, you're talking about, you can't really offend you because you've put the work into it. You stand by the book. So if someone says something else, it's like, that's fine. I'm confident in my work. So someone else not liking it, it's no big deal. Versus, I don't know, Michael, Adrian, is there something where there's an aspect of the book that you know, like, I don't think this part was the best for this book. Like, I know I was, this character didn't work for me even at the final product of, it's not my best part. And someone criticizes that, and that's when it hurts, when there's, like, a nugget of truth that you believe.
Yeah, I think it's two things. If there's that nugget of truth and they just nail you, that actually doesn't hurt so much, but it can hurt if, like, they do it so well and it's like revealing it. You're like, oh yeah, yeah. That,
if you didn't know about it beforehand.
So right, yeah. I think what hurts a little more now is if someone just seems to have, I don't know, like, almost like willfully misunderstood the book, or, like, misinterpreted it, or just got something so wrong. And obviously people sometimes they misread, or they don't. And sometimes that's, you know, you have to think, oh, have I not done this good job at explaining this part, conveying this part? But occasionally it's just in the hole, like in the room, someone just writes a review up that it's like, did you read the book right? Did you read the book that I wrote? Like, it seems like a completely sort of, I don't want to say wrong, but just say oh my goodness, how did you come to that conclusion? And it makes me think, oh God, did I screw up that badly that they think this? And then they believe, you presume that they believe wholeheartedly these things about the story or these things about the characters or the writing, which you just feel like are not there at all. So I think that works more because it just feels so wrong. It's like, no, that's not, it's like complete opposite of what I was doing. But it's, did you muck up? Did they just not, get it? You know, you have to, again, take those on the chin and go, but these days that's what affects me more, I think, than the grains of truth, because I'm pretty harsh on myself and I know where the weaknesses are. And if someone points out, it's like, okay, fair. I knew that.
Yeah.
I knew that one. Yeah.
I'm in agreement there. Yeah, it's like the nugget of truth is like, I knew that was there. And that's something that I know going forward that I'm going to be more, as a storyteller, more conscious of. Mm-hmm. But that misinterpretation thing, for sure. It's like the main character in Mushroom Blues is quite racist towards the mushroom people. There's a lot of conversation about racism and discrimination and othering and alienation in the book. But for me, like, it would hurt more if someone was like, Adrian's a racist based on their interpretation of the book.
Wait till I read your one-star review I found.
That kind of thing is more frustrating when they're like, they assume something about the author based on something that they misinterpreted about the book.
That's very frustrating. That's 2024 living on the internet today. I mean, Austin and Richard, I'm sure you guys experience it in your YouTube comment section sometimes, right? Like, someone misinterprets, and it's often willful. It's often a preteen who's just trying to start.
No, you're wrong. It's often people who pay us on Patreon. It's often those people who hate us the most. I don't get why.
We get the most
hate from them.
Yeah, it is true.
But you're right, Keith.
They pay $10 a month to badmouth us to our face.
Yeah, it's great.
That's fine.
It's that fine line between love and hate, right?
But yeah, Keith, you're totally right.
I mean, I will say that I'd say 10 years ago when I was getting my undergrad degree and I was in a creative writing class and I had some like natural talent and stuff, and like, we're going around in circles and going over the work and stuff. And pretty much everyone in the class was saying like, Keith did great, Keith, that this is awesome, I have nothing to say, blah, blah, blah. Then this girl, Rhiannon Kelly, changed my life, and she just kicked my ass in front of everyone in the thing. And I was boiling, and when I was like walking home from class, I stormed home, got really like pissed off, and it was stemming from a place of deep insecurity about my own work. And it only took, when I read her work, when it was her turn to pass her story around, and I was like, holy shit, she knows what she's talking about. I should go back to these notes. So like I said, like that's where she changed my life in terms of critique and criticism from someone who's like genuinely trying to like help you out. And then for years, for my first two books, I was sending it to her. I was like, please just let it tear me apart. Like, Rhiannon, like, so.
That brings up that point you're saying about how people that you do admire, trust, and go, man, I really do hold this person to a high regard and what they say about my book. So putting that into the award framework where, Adrian, you're a finalist, Keith, you got this award for humor for, and let me be sure I get this right, the Forward Reviews 2023 Book of the Year Award. So with winning a review, it feels so good, but what about, guess if you're in that contest, let's say for Adrian, you are there and you end up not winning the ultimate SPFBO, you get to finalists. That's still incredible. That's a huge honor. But what would you say to getting that far? And like, you want to get an award, but don't get that. Does that bring a drain? Maybe it's not direct criticism, but it's, I wasn't awarded by the people I do actually respect.
Right. I think in this particular case, it's like, I've followed SPFBO for enough years that I know a lot of the people who have made it to the finals, and I know many of the finalists.
Yeah.
And what I've seen is basically like, once people get to the finals, there's like an intense sense of camaraderie between those 10 people. Mm. To the point where it's like, we have a private Discord, and in years past, it's like the SPFBO finalists will do panels together. They'll bolster each other's work. They'll help each other out when they need to. A lot of the time they become friends, they become critique partners, they become whatever. So just the fact that I got to the finals is like, all right, I published my debut novel 7 months ago, and I applied for SPFBO and made it to top 10 of 300, which for me is like, I'm satisfied with that. You know what I mean? That's not something for me to scoff at. So I'm satisfied getting to this point, knowing that the 10 people that even like putting aside finalists, like the 300 people who were in the competition, it's like my sense of competitiveness has, as I've gotten older, developed into more of like a sense of community, where I don't necessarily see my book in competition with other books that are out there. Like literally a month before Mushroom Blues came out, I just saw randomly on social media, this guy named Austin Cheery, who's a writer from the States, released a fungal noir book. And I'm like, shit. Like, what?
What are the odds?
What are the odds of this, dude?
Yeah.
In literally a month span, two people from completely disparate parts of the world, different lives, different everything, decided, I'm going to write a fungal noir book and then I'm going to release it this time of the year. So actually, like, we've gotten to know each other and we'll write back and forth, and he's a really great guy. And I don't see it as like, don't even.
I'll stop.
That was a low hanging fruiting body. Come on.
I'm ashamed.
I have to ask you, how many fungi puns are in your book? There's
no fungi puns.
You're better man than I am.
There are fungi jokes. Yeah. Rip it in half. Burn it.
That's my version. That's my copy. Don't hurt that.
One star. No fungi jokes.
Did you actually throw my book?
Not enough, Adrian. God, you failed me. I read one, for the puns.
One star.
One
bullshit.
Star.
Yeah.
I might even have a fungi pun in my book. There are mushrooms in my book as too. Wait, nice. It's called collective consciousness. We're all drawing from the same well of creativity. Ooh, yeah.
And see, Adrian, that's why Keith has better reviews, because he's got the puns.
He's got the puns.
Man, I missed the boat, man. I'm a dad, too. I don't even have any dad jokes in there.
Terrible.
It's terrible. Absolutely terrible.
Just jumping off that, I think it's worth, like, well, I guess with Keith as well, but these awards, like, you know, it's great to be in them, it's great to win them, but it's also, like, in the day, it's just, like, those judges' opinions, and it doesn't actually... It might not, it's not going to make or break your career, probably. Like, I flamed out, Ascendant flamed out hard of the SPFBO, like, back in this day. Hasn't done it any problem, okay? Like, it, you know, sometimes competitions and things like this, it can be great, and you can be great if you make friends. Like, I made friends for that back in 2016 as well. But if your book doesn't get through these rounds, it doesn't actually mean that it's a bad book. It doesn't mean that people don't like your book or won't like your book. It's just that person, that judge's opinion at that point in that they've done it. It's still just an opinion. And it sucks to, you know, get negative feedback or to not make the cut of something. But plenty of big books that win huge awards don't sell, and plenty of books that sell tons don't get awards. It's like, it's not a make or break thing. So, like, don't take it too on, you know, don't be too hard on yourself if that has happened to you. And I see, especially the SPFBO, I see people put so much weight on it. So not like the final, you know, but I mean, like, people who don't make, because it's so popular now, guys. Richard Norton, I don't know if you know, but there's like 300 books that can enter a year, and that's the max, right? But there's far more books that want to enter than there is space for. And so that don't make it in, I see a lot of anxiety. Like, I didn't make it in, oh my God, oh no. It's like, it's okay, do it next year, like, try again. It's like, it's not the end of the world. It's a bit of community fun in some ways. But if you see that as your ticket to success, like, don't, like, you keep working on your stuff, you keep working on your things. Like, that's like a bonus. That's it, you know? Sometimes it goes well and sometimes it doesn't. There's almost no single one thing. I can't think of a single review that could, like, completely make you, completely break you.
I completely agree with that.
Yeah.
It's like, they're, because I've seen it in my friend groups, I've seen it in people who've gotten knocked out, I've seen it in the past, where there is far too much weight put into certain things. And my attitude with something like SPFBO has been, I entered my book and I will just ignore it until things happen. And if things don't happen, that's fine. If I get kicked out, that's fine. If I make it to the next stage, awesome. I happened to be in Glasgow with Michael and a bunch of other amazing authors for Worldcon, and that's when I found out that I made it to the semifinals. And then last month I found out that I got to the finals. But it wasn't like at any point during those times I was like, oh, just anxiety ridden, because I'm like, when is my review going to be out? When am I going to be announced? Blah, 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 blah. None of that stuff. Like, I haven't paid attention to it. Someone else told me that I made it to the finals, because it's like I just didn't even pay attention to it. And I think there's a lot of weight that is put into these things that the value is entirely inherent upon your subjective opinion about what that value is. You know, it's like if you feel like it's the biggest thing in the world, then it's the biggest thing in the world. If it's another cool addition to, you know, like I look at how Mushroom Blues has done since its launch, and I'm really, really proud of what it's done. SPFBO is not like top of the list, you know? It is another thing that I'm proud of in an accumulative group of achievements that I've managed to reach with that book. But I've seen SPFBO finalists or winners go on to get agents, go on to get, you know, like traditional book deals and things like that. But that is not entirely dependent on SPFBO. SPFBO gives you visibility, yes, but it also depends on the personal drive and ambitions of that particular author and the ways in which they were able to leverage their position in the competition. So the competition didn't do everything for you, doesn't do everything for you. It's how you view your personal ambitions and how you work your ass off in order to achieve things using the leverage of certain things that you have garnered. So if you win SPFBO, doesn't mean you're going to get a traditionally published book out of it. Doesn't mean you're going to get an agent. But you have the opportunity to leverage that, to go to an agent and say, hey, this book won SPFBO. Would you consider representing me and potentially pitching this book to editors to do a traditionally published version? That's something you can do. But it all depends on the individual author and the things that are meaningful to them. Because like Mike said, SPFBO and all these competitions, they are subjective based on the reviewers and the teams that are reviewing the books throughout the competition. You can get a review, you can get a reader who hates your book. You can also get a reviewer who hates your book. So it's all subjective and it all depends on the value that you yourself place on these things.
Well said, Adrian, because like the reason I applied for the award in the first place is because I was under the impression that maybe winning an award would bring in more readers, and that's not the case at all. It is all about how do you leverage this award, and to this day, I have been unable to do so in a way without feeling like an asshole. However... In the email to Tudor Ramble, I did. That was like, this is the one time I successfully leveraged it, like hitting up guys.
That's not what it was. I think it was all the times you like tickled our ego in it. It was not the award too.
That's a great way to get to people.
I mean,
don't tickle your own ego. Ego tickle mine. Come on.
But I haven't even made a video about, like, I'm on TikTok. That's primarily my social media. Mm-hmm. And I haven't even made a video about my award because I don't know how to, like do it without coming off as, I don't know, something that makes me feel deeply uncomfortable to be, especially in front of a camera.
Right. It makes
okay, what you said about how awards don't necessarily pick up readers is because, like, you know, one, most readers don't have a clue what these things are. And
correct.
You know, even something like the Hugos, like I've got a very good friend who worked in Watchstones, you know, in the UK for a long time, specifically like selling SFF books. And like, he said, yeah, maybe occasionally someone would come in looking for the Man Booker book, you know? No one came in asking, what was the latest Hugo winner book? No, no one ever did that. Just no one asked for it. No one, the average people coming into a shop or browsing Amazon aren't looking up who won the Hugo as such. Like it's a very, like it doesn't necessarily find you new readers. Or in the great numbers, like, yeah, it's it can be prestigious, it can give you a nice ego boost, it can be a feather in your cap, you could possibly leverage it for other things, but yeah, if your goal is readers, you've got to go and do all the other stuff anyway, and this is all just bonus material.
Exactly. Although I will say the self-published reading community, I think is a little bit more attuned to things like this. where people who generally read traditionally published books go to a Waterstones, for instance. They're like, yeah, like Mike said, they're not going in saying, show me the latest Hugo Award winner, because the Hugo Awards are for writers. The Hugo Awards are for the industry. That's the kind of award that will leverage your position within the publishing industry, with agents, with editors, that kind of thing. Whereas something like SPFBO, I have noticed that there is a lot of reader engagement and community engagement, because I think that is a reflection upon the people who read self-published fiction are generally more engaged online, because the ways in which they access self-published books and information about authors and the stuff that they're releasing is online. So the fact that their ecosystem is online based on the stuff that they read, that kind of facilitates a deeper engagement with something like SPFBO. Whereas Hugo, it's like very, like, I think it's streamed online, maybe, but the majority of people who are watching something like the Hugo Awards are authors or people who work in the publishing industry, not necessarily readers. And readers are not necessarily going to say, I'm automatically going to buy the Hugo Award winner.
Right. The Oscars are for the actors and the teams. Yeah. It's not for the average movie watcher.
Talking about these different criticisms, and especially for you guys, for all three of you, any criticism that you have gotten has clearly not broken you or, you know, destroyed or tanked any kind of sales. Like, it's just a part of it, but generally move on. But in your experience, have you come across any other fellow authors that where the criticism did build up, where it actually just destroyed their chances of, like, did it, where criticism actually did hurt sales, hurt the author in the sense of I'm not writing anymore? Like, have you guys experienced that with anyone you know?
I think for me personally, just friends where it's not necessarily affected sales or anything like that, but it's more that the criticism very much hurt their ability to create. So I think that's probably, I mean, like, a lot of authors are quite self-critical people to begin with. So that kind of like hampered their ability to continue to pursue the art form in a satisfying way to them. Because they always think like, is this decision that I'm going to make in regards to the next book going to be criticized in X number of ways by the people who criticized my last book, right? Mm-hmm. And especially when it comes to toxic fandoms, people who are like, you know, crazy, crazy in love with, you know, Rothfuss or Martin or Scott Lynch or whatever, the people who have multi-million dollar selling books series, but just neglect to release new books. And then anybody who kind of veers within the territory that fandom deems too close to the thing that they are in adoration of, then I have seen, you know, fans of Rothfuss, you know, especially lash out at other authors who they feel are copycats or what have you. Mm. When in reality, if you look at publishing as a whole, go on to Amazon and look at all the books that are in there. Look at how many thrillers are copies of, what is it, Jack Reacher or something like that. Oh, yeah. Look at how many romances are copy of blah, blah, blah.
How many Jack Reacher books are copies of Jack Reacher? It's the same thing.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
It's the same thing over and over again.
Right. But the thing is that there's, I don't know, just like a certain fandoms that encapsulate this very toxic attitude towards anybody that they deem encroaching upon something that they find to be kind of like holy text within SFF kind of thing. And like Mike, like Dragon Rider fantasy, so many people would be like, you're copying Aragorn and blah, 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 blah. And it's like, get over yourself and understand that if you don't have any more Aragorn books, you now have Michael R. Miller or Ryan Cahill or whoever you want to read. They're there now.
So going about the Inheritance and Cycle fans, lovely, wonderful people. like maybe one has been very mean. And that dismissive thing of, oh my God, this thing. I have had a few of them come very earnestly question, like, did I ask for Christopher's permission to write my series? Did I do that? I just did that's my stuff. You know? But they are huge. Like they were Inheriting Cycle fans who are hardcore, and I love them. I kind of know where they live on Facebook. I pop in there sometimes, and they just love that series. And it might be the only series they've ever read as well. But they love it to bits. But they have been nothing but lovely to Songs of Chaos.
I'm glad that fandom is not toxic.
I'll be honest. I'm surprised you aren't getting more. It's not a book, but like I'm surprised you're not getting more hounding from fans of How to Train Your Dragon. That would be.
Right. Yeah.
Maybe they don't overlap. Movie book.
I guess
those
not.
DreamWorks fans are pure darlings. Yeah. Apparently.
Everyone that likes Dragon Might is just chill. I don't know.
To give the context, Mike, I actually read your book before started a YouTube channel because on Audible basically it came looking at audiobook narrators and I was like this narrator, he does another book, bye, okay, cool. And so that's how I read your book the first time as well. So
there you go. And that's why you pick great narrators that do big series that you get that nice crossover.
I'm curious from all you two, because from Rich and I's perspective of reviewing a book, it's helpful so the reviewers ourselves, okay, we get to put our thoughts out there. What do we think about it? We get to compare in our own heads. What do I like to read? Obviously, when people review it themselves. For people that watch us that are just readers, they look for, okay, do they think the same as me? Is there something I missed? Maybe it's been a while since I read it. What's something that these two reviewers that I like or don't like, whatever it might be for that, of what do they think? It could help in some way there. Also, some people, it could be unhelpful to others. But it's going to the author that would ever go and seek out a review. We've been talking about how there can, ignore the haters. Awards, it's what you do with the award. Is there any value, not just the beta phase, not the feedback, but the criticism when you get a review? Is there a benefit to you when you read it? If it's maybe if it's negative or positive, what's something good that can come out of criticism or a review of your books?
I've got a good one, and I'm surprised I didn't lead with this story.
Oh, please.
This is a good one. So when I released Dragon's Blade 3, March 2018, there was a few, I guess I didn't know it was as weak as it was at the end, but I didn't have as many beta readers back then. There's all kinds of reasons why, but it was a little weak on the ending, right? And there was a lot of feedback. I would say about 20% of the reviews mentioned that they felt the ending was like rushed or confusing or didn't work for them. It was all different opinions, right? That's the thing. Everyone, a lot of people said something different, but the general consensus was, ooh, that ending didn't work for me. Right.
Okay.
And so I had to. So I was like, "Oh, right, okay, what's going on there?" And later in 2018, I did a lot of editing. I heavily re-edited and rewrote the first book, and then I put all the three books into a box set. And then it was the ebook box set which actually took off and sort of was my break. Okay. And what I was able to do was add two additional chapters to the end of book three. You know, this was now long time after the fact, with a benefit of hindsight and a bit of break, and be like, oh, those two chapters should have always been there. I don't know why. Maybe I just was exhausted, to like ran out of steam, but they should have always been there. And then once those chapters were added in, no comments about the ending ever again. Nothing. Like, everyone seems much happier with it. Like, anyone that doesn't like the ending, it's like 1 in 100 as opposed to 1 in 20 or something like that. And so I took that stuff on board and I internalized it. I knew I had like another chance with the box set. So I made some changes based on the feedback and it worked, or at least seemingly worked, because that's what the box set took off and, you know, the rest is history. And so there's a really positive way that if you engage with it properly, you can completely change your whole career. You could change your trajectory if you take it on board right and dig deep. Not to say you should go away and rewrite your books or anything like that you've already released. It's just that was something that was working at the time. Box sets, but that's something I did. And so I think that's a very positive story of taking on feedback.
I was just going to say it's a benefit of self-publishing that you can do something like that. Yeah. Just wanted to throw that out there.
Yes, you can. Yeah.
Something about that kind of makes me think of, is the general pain point valuable criticism? It's not necessarily the specifics. So when a reviewer or somebody else is critiquing it, saying the ending didn't work because X, the thing as a writer, it's more valuable to ignore the X. But the fact that they didn't work for him, that's the thing that to pay attention to. The ending didn't work. Yeah. And when they go on about how they would fix it, it's like, eh, probably not. But the fact that all these people didn't like the ending means there's something to change.
Yeah, and consensus in that case as well.
Consensus is people saying beta readers, everyone's saying beta readers too, right? Like every beta reader who probably aren't, beta readers probably aren't professional writers or people in the industry, they're just readers or fans or friends. And if everyone says chapter 10 is bad, but they'll all have a different opinion on why it's bad. So you have to diagnose the problem. All you know for sure is chapter 10 is you need to work on chapter 10. It's a bit like going to the doctor saying, I've got a headache or a stomachache. And it's like, oh God, that could be 100 different things.
When it comes to cleaning your house, you probably wish you were switched at birth with a millionaire heirs and suddenly have a staff like in the telenovelas. Or even better, un galán with a trust fund swept in and passed the mop to your evil stepmom. Hola, ¿qué tal? It's Chiquis. And even though life isn't always like in the telenovelas, Fabuloso brings a clean that's always over the top. With 2 times more active ingredients to take the drama out of any mess and a remarkable lavender fragrance for your floors, counters, windows, and heart, a dramatically clean home? Now that's true amor ever after. Fabuloso. Fabuloso is also bringing the freshness to My Cultura Podcast Network by helping to share our Latinx voices. Listen to new episodes of your favorite My Cultura shows on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Fabuloso's 2x concentrated formula provides 2x more active ingredients versus non-concentrated Fabuloso original. Use as directed.
You know, the author, have to diagnose what the problem actually is and then fix it. Right. Yeah, you won't find that whether, it's like a heat map, I guess is what Rich was saying, almost like you'll get a lot of activity bunching around certain points. And then once you see that, you're like, okay, I need to look at this properly and really see what and try to figure out what might really be happening, because everyone might be saying X, Y, Z, but it could actually be something completely
yeah, that's different. That's a good way of parsing through your feedback. That's how a writer... That's a great way to adjust, and it keeps the creativity ball in your court, sort of. I will say, as someone with only 20 reviews on Amazon and 20 reviews on Goodreads, any review that comes in is just gives me a zap of dopamine. So in terms of value, that's always nice. I'm still in that stage, nothing more to add. That's exciting.
that for YouTube stuff, when we got comments at first going, oh my God, new comment, a subscriber. And then as it goes on, you get more of a consensus, because as you get a larger audience, I guess you and I talked about this in one episode, objective versus subjective when it comes to art. Now, one of the things we came to there was, obviously you can't just say, hey, this is a, there are features you can look at a microscope and go, okay, this does this, because this one's more fast paced objectively because it has shorter sentences. You can look micro.
The more narrow you are, you can be objective in the more narrow you get on an aspect. You can be more objective on sentence structure compared to genre.
Is the ending better? Ending. Yeah.
Like you can, if you subjectively pick what are the important things you're looking for? And then of those, what is it that you're looking? Eventually you can get to some level of objectivity of X versus Y.
But like then
there is some degree of, I can confidently say, The Lord of the Rings is better written than 50 Shades of Grey. I can say that like an objective fact. It's better written.
Right.
Do you mean by better? What do you mean? So it comes
exactly
to all
right, but then you're getting into conversations of genre expectations. Yep. It's like if someone's going into 50 Shades of Grey with the expectation of, I want a steamy romance, and certain style of writing,
it's better in that way.
It's better in that regard. If someone goes into The Lord of the Rings and says, I want a steamy romance, and all they get is Aragorn and...
when you get more micro and go, it's when you say, hey, it's better written, you mean better because better to you means it does this, this, and this, and this with
where the writing. 50 Shades of Grey is repetitive and does their sentence structure.
So your definition is not exactly.
I'm specifically talking writing because I think sales wise, 50 Shades of Grey.
Oh yeah,
sold way more than Lord of the Rings.
Oh
no!
I don't think so.
Lord of the Rings is like top three.
Lord of the Rings is the top. Like one of the top books ever.
I thought 50 Shades of Grey actually outpaced it.
Like Lord of the Rings is up there, like top five with like Harry Potter.
I have like six copies of Lord of the Rings, and I've never read the story. So,
you contributed to the sales. You contributed to the sales, Keith.
But
I don't want to live in the timeline that 50 Shades of Grey sold Lord of the Rings.
Rich already lived in that timeline, so
I lived that.
We just brought him out of that multiverse
again. You understand why? All the things of democracy is cringe. That's one of the examples of I'm going like, look at 50 Shades of Grey and how well it sold. It's like,
it
this
sold
is why
than
I
a
don't
lot,
trust people.
But not Lord of the Rings. I mean,
I don't
still
trust
sold
people because of that.
But that
seems that we opened up the can of worms. So we'll go and
Keith is doing a middle school hands
raise hand function.
A middle school teacher's raising his
teacher.
Yeah, Keith.
Former middle
he practices
teacher.
What he
former.
Teaches.
Former. Yes.
I'm a recovering middle school teacher. I now work at Trader Joe's. Okay. Here's the valuable thing that I could say for today, especially because it's not looking like I'll be writing again anytime soon. But for Michael and Adrian, and I know Austin, you're working on a book, right?
Yes, just finished another chapter today. I'm feeling great.
Awesome.
He may finish another one next month.
Maybe next year. We'll get there. Michael, thank you for that talk. We had help a lot. Yeah.
I've done some developmental editing myself, and the most valuable piece of advice I could give in terms of giving feedback or receiving feedback, the thing that kind of changed my life and cracked my head wide open in terms of like how to approach revision in a story is not asking what works and what doesn't work. Instead, ask yourself the question, what does the story want to become? Those are two different things. Working with what doesn't work, if you ask that one question, it will naturally force you to adjust all the things that are working and not working. If you could just answer the question, what does this part, what does this chapter, what does this book want to become after you finish your draft?
Okay, what does the story need? Like, what does the story want? And
not just the story, but like, I think you can go from like macro to micro. Yeah. There, you could be like, okay, you could hone it into like a character arc for a very specific character. Be like, who does this character want to become? You know, and I think want, that particular verb, kind of plays into the fact that characters and stories tend to develop a life of their own as you're writing them. And so there are things that happen in Mushroom Blues that were completely spontaneous, that veered far off course from my outline based on what I saw that the character was doing and what I determined their want to be. Right. So you can give your beta readers, you can give people who are critiquing you more helpful feed. Basically, you're setting them up for more helpful feedback by giving them the right question to think about when they're reading your book.
Questions, if you're saying, are the like, most valuable thing.
Yeah, it's like if you're saying like chapter 10, I think chapter 10 sucks, and that reader goes in with the expectation that either it sucks, like you said, or, you know, it's like it's creating a dichotomy already around this. But if you give them the freedom with the right lead-in questions to think about your story in a particular way.
And the question is often why?
Yeah. Those are the kinds of questions that will get their brain churning in ways that are more valuable for you as a writer who's going to then go back and reapply that. Because like we said, like specific criticism doesn't help. You know, I kind of view it as like predator mode, where you have like the infrared vision of the predators from the movies, where you're like the heat map thing that you both have mentioned before, and Mike, you mentioned that you're trying to hone in on like an amorphous blob of something that isn't working. And that amorphous blob, you take that and you try to determine what that blob is supposed to be doing, what that blob wants to do. And then like Plato, you kind of like shape it into something that you
like
feel
a network,
works.
Like a fungus. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Bring it back, buddy.
I have a question for Michael or Adrian or Austin. If you guys have ever experienced getting criticism on a part that for you sucked to write. Like you, it was just a nightmare. You spent weeks on this part, and like, and then that's where the criticism is drilling in. It's usually when you're struggling as a writer, that's usually where people naturally tend to hone in and say, like, this part sucks. Like,
I have one thought on that. If I could just jump it off to you, TB, is this goes along with that, the subjective point I was getting at too, where I think in that feedback stage, when I'm going, a buddy of mine in my small writing group gives feedback to something of, man, he worked on it, they say it sucks. It goes back to that point of, when one person says that, how much do you hold their opinion on what your book and what you know it needs to be versus when the book is out there, and that in that discussion of objective versus subjective, when we were talking about how subjective universality, or in this case, a plurality with Michael or your book, that ending, people pointed out like something didn't work here. They didn't have the exact solution, but something didn't work. Enough people said it that went, okay, red alarm goes off. There's something there to add. Or no, it's not, maybe not objectively wrong, but enough people notice it, where I think a tough part about that feedback stage when someone, and please, Adrian, Michael, if you feel the same, when you're getting feedback from a smaller group of beta readers, can it be tough to go, man, okay, I really trust this person, but you have to take it with a different grain of salt, because what if you just get two completely opposite opinions on the same chapter? Because does it help to have more people looking at it, or just really fine tune, okay, these three people really know me and what I'm trying to write? And sorry, Keith, if that still stays on topic with your question there of getting feedback on that part you write a lot. And Keith, does that, because I don't want to go off your question as well.
That's in line.
Perfect. Yeah. Adrian, Michael, what do you guys think about that?
Go for it, Mike.
I don't have that. I don't have tons of beta readers. I'll go for like if ARC readers, like advanced readers and things like that. Now, I don't have tons and tons of beta readers, partly because the books are really big. You know, the last one was 250,000 words. This one's probably going to be about the same. And this tight production schedules and all this sort of stuff. And actually, if you say to people, hey, you need to read this book in 2 weeks because I need feedback, like people just, it's a lot of pressure for people, and most of them can't do it. And if they do, they're going to rush about so I tend to rely on a really close friend who's like, works as an editor at Portal. And he is like the best developmental editor in the world. He can take that bird's eye view of things. He can like find little problems. And even if he doesn't diagnose it correctly, I'm like, oh yeah, that's set off the thing in my brain. Close family, couple of friends. My dad's actually a great beta reader because he isn't a big fantasy reader. He likes to read, he will read fantasy books. So like when something gets big, like Game of Thrones, Lord of the Rings, whatever, like he'll read those books, but he doesn't generally pick up a fantasy book. So he's the most kind of casual reader that you could, for the genre that you could find. And so when he goes, hey, this area here, I was a bit confused, this was a bit slow for me, it's actually in some ways more useful because he's not getting too much into the weeds of magic system or the world building,
right.
This novel or that novel, right? He's just sort of purely from just reading it kind of raw and being like, I was a bit bored at this point. In some ways, that's a lot more useful than getting an essay on like how this compares to this, to the all the way down. To Keith's question, yeah, on book three, there was a chapter that was like, for some godforsaken reason, 10,000 words long. Clearly, I was this thing, right?
10,000.
Wow. Yeah, it was bad. It was bad. And I gave out that very rough draft for some feedback, and my dad rightly pointed out, yeah, that's a bit long. It was a bit, that dragged a bit. I was like, yeah, I know that. But I knew it was long, I knew it sucked, but I kind of had to hear that. And then I managed to cut that bloody thing down to 5,000, which I thought was a good going. So, I think to Keith's point, yes. If that was a hard part and it comes back, yeah, because it's like you almost get PTSD. You remember what it was like writing that terrible chapter. Exactly. But
you're like, I know.
Yes, I know. Don't tell me. Yeah. Yes. You're just embarrassed. You're almost embarrassed. You're like, oh, I forgot about that. I blocked it out. I don't know, Adrian, what about you? If you had something
I think I have. I have three very close beta readers. Crystal Matar, author of Legacy of the Brightwash, and MJ Kuhn, author of Among Thieves and co-host on my podcast, SFF Addicts. And then another friend, Peter Hartog. And the three of them, it's like I trust their their criticism implicitly, because I know that they are, okay, this is something that I find very important. They're engaging with the work in such a way where they're able, like Michael's editor friend, to disengage with the book to a certain degree, such that their author brain doesn't tell them, I need to tell Adrian how to write the story in the way I would write it. Mm. The best kind of criticism you can receive is when, especially from authors. So be wary with author friends who are critiquing your work or what have you, that they view your book as if they were in your shoes, as if they were seeing it through your own eyes, such that they don't force upon your story their ideas and their notions of how that story should be. So I'm really, really lucky that those three all understand my writing style. They all understand what I want to do narratively. And so they're very, very helpful. MJ and Crystal were especially helpful because my main character is a middle-aged woman. And Keith, this kind of plays into your point as well. Earlier on, it was a lot harder for me to kind of like capture her voice, to capture the voice and feeling and essence of a middle-aged woman. And so MJ and Crystal were very helpful in saying things like, a woman would never say that. If I was her, I would be thinking about X, Y, Z as a woman. And so that was really helpful in the first 10 chapters, where I was kind of trying to establish her voice a lot more. And then as I went along, the book has 40 chapters. It just became more and more second nature to me. And the latter three quarters of the book feel much stronger as a result of that, because it's like they helped me get over that hurdle of feeling comfortable putting myself into Henrietta's shoes and kind of like living the story as her. And then at the same time, there are certain chapters where I'm like, God damn, it's hard to kind of get through this.
Oh, I think we lost Adrian on our side. Cool. Did you guys lose him?
Adrian.
I thought the world was ending for a second. Like everything.
Yeah. Oh, we'll have him jump back into
it. It should be okay in recording, but we can't hear him now.
So we can't respond to Adrian. So, okay.
Ruh-roh.
But
seeing how we ramble about, seeing how you opened that can of worms about objectivity and subjectivity, right?
Yeah.
If people point out actual mistakes, you have to take that on board, okay? If you break your world building, if your magic, if you break your rules with your magic, if you're doing fantasy, if you've done something without any setup, like setup and payoff, I think it's very hard. Like, you shouldn't be giving a payoff without setup. It probably doesn't work. You know, like there are some things that they're just quite mechanical. And if people catch that, then you should take that very seriously. The difference between something being quite hard, like that hard-nosed, and just an opinion, you know, we're talking about like beta reading stuff still, but
Adrian,
if you bring your world building, that's wrong. It's not subjectively wrong. It is just wrong. Adrian's
sorry,
back.
My internet just crapped out for a second. So
Michael saved the day. Don't worry.
Thank you for stepping in, Michael.
John Michael.
But there's one scene. It's like an interrogation scene that takes place about three quarters of the way through the book, and that one was very hard to write just because I knew it had a lot of juggling to do. How it was sort of dealing with everything that had happened up until that point in the book. And it was one of the villains, and it was doing a lot in terms of Henrietta and her partner Koji in terms of their characterization. And it was sort of leading up towards how to set up the end, like the tail of the book. And so it was like balancing a lot of this different stuff. And that scene, I ended up microdosing with some mushrooms while writing that scene, because it also happens to be like a hallucinatory sort of
method writing
interrogation. Yeah, very much method writing. Yeah. I struggled with that scene for like a week, and then I wrote it microdosing, and all of the pieces fell together. And when my beta readers read it, they loved that scene. And then when I've seen it mentioned in reviews, it's been very positive. So that one was like a struggle to work through, but I feel like, you know, in a very meta way, I was able to use mushrooms as a way to sort of like unlock that part of my brain that was holding me back from completing it.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that.
I'm
not saying like if you're struggling at a part, it's going to suck. I'm just saying like if you're struggling at a part, that's where you got to make sure it doesn't suck.
Right.
Yeah. But sometimes you can feel like that's a hell of a thing that's terrible, and actually come back a week later and it's fine. Like sometimes you just had a bad day, right? Sometimes you just went in the mood, you had a bad sleep, and it's actually fine.
And that's why revision is great. Hard.
Yeah. I have a question for Adrian and Keith, if everyone's still got time. Like, is there anything that you love about one of your book, a story? Maybe you did tons of research and you thought you nailed this moment. This is the bit. And you can't wait for everyone in the reviews to mention that bit as their favorite bit. Mm. No one talks about it. No one mentions it. And you're just like, come on, that.
Keith, go for it. You put your hand up.
I mean, yeah, so I was hyper aware for this book to not have a sagging middle. Like the middle is usually where these problems seem to emerge. So I was like mentally preparing myself, like going to the gym, running, like when I got to the middle of the book, like I am going to come at the middle of my book with my best stuff right now. I'm just so proud. I think the book only gets better and better as you keep going. But no one's mentioned that in the reviews or anything. my reviews are collecting dust, so I don't.
But what I will say is if you don't have a saggy middle, it's good that no one mentions it, because if you do have a saggy middle, they will just berate you nonstop for it. Fair. It's like if there's one section of your book that a reader feels is weak, then it's like it sucks, you know?
We're
like,
so guilty of that. Yeah, so damn guilty of that. We do that all the time.
We do that all the time.
We're like, you know, the pace was off from here to here.
The pacing.
Right, exactly.
The pacing, 3.42.
Yeah. In the beginning, I was running the audiobook at 1.2 speed. And by the time I got to the middle of the book, I was going at 2.2 speed on the audiobook. It was just slow.
Man. Yeah, but I think if no one mentions it, then that's actually kind of a good thing.
Definitely.
You know, they could say like I liked the pace overall, but I doubt someone would be like, oh, that middle sure as hell wasn't saggy. <You
know? laughs> That is kind of weird when you think about it.
Everyone remembers when you messed up. No one remembers when you do it well.
Yeah, right. That's right. Like, I think for me, like kind of similar to Keith, is like I spend a lot of time thinking about the pacing of the book in general, not just like a saggy middle or anything, but how I structured my chapters, how I paced my chapters. I would basically write out chapter by chapter of my entire book on a piece of paper and then turn it sideways and create like a little like roller coaster diagram of the intensity of each scene to sort of see how that plays into the pacing of the book. So those were kinds of things that I was thinking about.
That sounds
but
sounds
people,
like a mushroom idea.
So just write a book and then make a roller coaster.
Like connect the roller coaster across. Yeah. Like just. I see you taping things to the wall of like, the roller coaster has to go up right here.
It is a police procedural.
That's a twist.
It is a police procedural. So you can imagine me with like papers scattered all over the floor, like connecting the dots with pins and like all that stuff. But the pacing is like, it's something that people say, like if they like fast pace, they're like, I'm into it. But for the most part, people don't really mention the pacing, which I'm happy about. Cause if the pacing was bad, then it would be something that they mentioned. So I put a lot of work into it, but I don't necessarily need, you know, my ego's okay with not, you know, coveting every single mention of my pacing in reviews and stuff like that.
And also like the other thing I'm proud of is the structure of the book. And I know that nobody who reads it is going to pick up on it, but like, or maybe now they will, I don't know. But my book, the intention was it's structured like a spider web. That's why you see a big spider web on the cover. So as you get to the middle of the book, it gets like denser, and like there's a huge paragraph that's like that just goes on for like 6 pages, and you're in the center of the web, and everything is like super confusing, and you feel like a bug that's like trapped inside it. Mm-hmm. And then you get through that middle, and then it starts to get easier, and you fight your way out of the web. No one's going to say anything about that, but like,
I think I found it. Look,
everyone of Keith's readers.
Oh, yeah, you're
fly
right.
In his web.
Oh, that's kind of.
I flipped right to it.
Huh.
In this case, it's a lopsided spider web because there was a chapter, and chapter 3 used to be 40 pages long that I condensed down to 10. So now it's like not in the direct middle anymore, but
super.
But it's cool. Like a little bit of a lopsided spider web.
Well,
if Michael, Michael's looking too, like look, there's.
Oh, wow. Those are some dense paragraphs.
Yeah. Yes.
That's meaty. That is meaty.
Like. Meaty.
Yeah, well, and it's relentless on the language as well. It's like makes you really have to pay attention.
Wow. Wow.
Well, Michael, you asked the question. Why don't you give us your answer?
Yeah.
You
listened to the first book, Richard. Have you listened to the second book? And it's
I have.
Cool if you haven't. Yeah.
Okay. So I've read so books 1 and 2. And then... Okay. I think I started reading Stormlight after that. And so.
Oh, that's a meek up then. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, that's on me. I got distracted.
Well, if you remember this, well, I'll explain a bit. Do you remember in book 2? There's a character that's forging axes. Mm-hmm. Okay, that whole process, like the end of that, I think it's the best thing I've ever written. I still think that. Because I did all this research, and I went out and learned all these blacksmithing techniques, right? And I was like, I want them to forge dragon-rider weapons, like, properly. No magic. Like, they're going to actually forge these things. It's going to be proper techniques with a little bit sprinkled in. I found, like, 2 historical techniques. I blended them together. It was perfect, okay? It was perfect. and that scene, it was brilliant world-building with, like, great character work. I just knew I nailed it, and it's my favorite thing I've ever written. And I was waiting for people to come in to praise the blacksmithing, like, go into the world.
Oh, is that what the axes you were talking about? About his book? That part is what you're talking about? I'm just kidding, Michael. I'm sorry.
I won't lie to save...
I was trying to make him feel a little good. You know, a little white lie.
Could give him a white lie.
But that part, you put all that research, you're like, man, somebody's going to pick up on this. Oh, I did so much research, and then you didn't get the reception that you thought people would be like, man, look at that.
Well, as everyone says, like, people just probably hopefully enjoyed it and didn't think about it because they enjoyed it, you know? They didn't think, because it just worked, they don't think about it, you know?
But it's not like all the one-star blacksmiths coming in there being like, fucking right, Michael R. Miller, your blacksmithing is false, sir.
Any blacksmith reading that, I think, would have to say, like, this guy knew his shit. Okay? Yeah, I've got a friend that's a blacksmith, and I had them check it, like, worked on it with them. But yes, you do all this work. That's like your little darling. You put so much into that element, into that scene, into that sequence, and you're hoping that someone's going to pick it out specifically. But it's a massive book and a big series, and why should people? But I just wondered if you guys had something like that, where you just really wanted people to like that.
Michael, I got another one. I'm sorry.
Go on.
Can I share another one? Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that cool?
Yeah.
I mean, I got this character. He's a high school principal who's sexually attracted to balloons, and there's this part... where he breaks into a lot to steal a bundle of balloons from a garage lot at 3 a.m. And the challenge of the part was getting so deep inside his head that it felt like a heist mission, like a bank with like the stakes of like robbing a bank. But like he's just stealing some balloons, you know, from a lot, and he almost gets caught, and it's like super intense. But like that's another part that I'm like, that's probably like the most fun part in terms of like. Page turning action.
Keith is going to get like 20 more reviews being like, dude has a balloon fetish.
I mean, I was going to say, like, Adrian, I know your book is in first person. Michael, do you also write in first? Because like,
no, third.
Are you in first, Michael?
No, my epic fantasies are third limited. My RPG was first, oddly. That's like a thing.
I can't stay trapped in a single voice like that for a full book. I don't know how you do that. That's insane. Like my ADHD, like I have to get inside like a bunch of different heads, and I do third limited at the scene breaks. But like that's the only way I could see myself like getting through a book is like being excited to go into, you know, this dude's head or her head. Like I can't do one head the whole time. That's insane to me.
I mean, it takes me being very invested in the character to know. Yeah. That I'm gonna stick with you for like 400 pages or whatever.
For me, it helped that it was short. It was a short book. You know, like it wasn't a Goliath epic. It was like, I think Battlespire is like 112,000 words, which I guess for some people feels longer, but it was a short book.
In the fantasy genre, that's a drop in the bucket.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Mushroom Blues is like 111, so it's the same thing. Yeah. I think if it was like 120 plus, then I would have trouble sticking with first person for the whole
time. Oh, yeah, you should, because we got to give them opportunity now where I want to read off your 1 and 5 star reviews when you guys get a chance here to pitch your book. And I think we got to start with Keith, because Keith, you need the reviews. You need these people to come out and you need to find a new 1 star review, because I have none to give you. I will read off the praise for your book and then please pitch, let them whimper. And everybody, please check this out. So Keith, do you want me to read off the first or second 5 star review that I found? There's more. These are the two I picked out.
The first.
First? All right. So Catherine on Goodreads says, let them
win. No, go second.
Okay.
Too late.
You know that review. Catherine.
I'm memorized.
No. Not Catherine. She calls me out for being a balloon fetishist.
All right. She's just really into balloons. That's why she rated it 5 stars.
The reason being preferably by someone I don't know. I know Catherine personally.
Perfect. Oh, okay. Do you know Annie?
I met her on TikTok, but yeah, go ahead.
Good enough. Okay. So Annie says, such a fun adventure with such fantastically weird and truly developed characters. The prose is beautiful and the action is gripping. The author has written every word with intention. I still think about this book all the time. Stop reading this and go read Let Them Whimper. 5-star review. And Keith, do you want to take a chance to let people, what is this balloon fetish book about? In the first place,
spiders.
Is it exclusively about people with balloon fetishes?
Oh, here.
No.
For here. I'm sorry, dude. I'm sorry.
No. It's great. No, it's fine. It's a genre blending black comedy about six weirdos facing down a bizarre apocalypse that's being pushed by an interdimensional entity. Lots of commentary on today's society. It's a very like America. It's like my thesis on America right now. Lots of stuff about, you know, themes about like how kindness, we're kind of going through like a kindness holocaust, is how I put it in the book. Like everyone's out for themselves. Nobody's looking out for anyone else but themselves. So that's like kind of like the theme that these six weirdos kind of have to wrestle with as they confront the entity. And the entity is, his name is Mr. Mooney. He's my villain, but he's been like a guardian over humanity for many, many millions of years. And he's been trying to give us chances. And we finally, like, he's just tired of us now. He's like, all right, that's it. 200 million years. I'm done with you guys. It's time to, you know, usher in a new species kind of thing.
Wow. So that is Let Them Whimper. And Rich, do you want to go off and read the intro to his book here?
Oh, yeah. I mean, sure.
We always got to give that first line, first paragraph or so. Yep.
All right. First line. Here comes my death, and fast. But we'll come to that later, at the end, which is now. It was coming, and fast. Too fast for local and national and international forecasters alike to pinpoint precisely what it was, much less reach a consensus. Frazzled meteorologists and weather experts worldwide spent no less than 3 weeks disputing the freaky splat on the Doppler as it barreled across the Pacific toward the Northern California coast, despite the cryptic absences of red-green couplets and telltale hook. The great majority sniffed and waggled their fingers and pegged the raging patterns twitching on screen for a tornado. Twisters themselves were not terribly uncommon. California had seen hundreds of little guys in the past decade alone, but this one, coloring much of the radar screen, a midnight shade of purple, moved with an exotic, skittish sort of life, and it was big.
Thank you for reading my least favorite part of the book.
Now let's find that six-page-long paragraph.
Yeah.
The first 5 pages are just a nightmare. I hate it. That's where I struggle the most.
It puts the vibe of you're in for some weird, wacky confusion. You're going to sit back. You're going to be confused a minute. This is going to get weird and wacky.
Definitely sets it up properly. And Keith, for everybody, so Keith, Adrian's, and Michael, all their links will be in the description below. So go check that out. That is Let Them Whimper. And now we should go. Michael, you'll go last. You got a bunch of reviews, okay? We'll go Adrian. Adrian next with Mushroom Blues. And now, which one do you prefer, Adrian? Do you want to hear your 5-star or your 1-star review first?
1-star. Let's bring on the negativity.
Okay, I got to say, this is the meanest one I could find. That was also within like the time limit of, it's not, you know, essay long. It's a paragraph, okay?
Right.
Here
is
we go.
Is it the person who hated on my glossary?
Their name is Tazio. Do you know a Tazio?
No.
Okay, this is a 1-star right. from them. It's brutal, okay. After more than 100 pages, this book wasn't getting anywhere interesting. It tries to talk about colonialism and racism, but does so without any originality or depth. Clearly written by a white dude who never had to be the target of racism in his life and so can only depict it in the crudest, most cliche terms. Also, after a while, the sheer number of reference to mushrooms, mycelium, and spores becomes annoying. I get it. Everything is made from mushrooms. It's not enough to make some setting interesting, you know? Really disappointing.
Oh, man.
So that's your 1-star review.
Boom, took it on the chin.
Yeah, man.
It got personal. It talks about the book.
I would say right, if you dislike mushrooms that much, you got 100 pages in. You got 100 pages in, man. You got a quarter of the way through the book. That is dedication. So thank you, sir.
To lighten that with the 5-star, would you like to hear that?
Sure.
Yes. This one is from Craig, and he says, 5 stars, a very accomplished debut. I thoroughly enjoyed it. The author has created something truly wonderful within this book. It has depth of understanding for those affected by personal trauma, war, racism, and occupation. The world is believable and relatable. The characters are flawed, and their relationships are complex and organic. I had a great time with this story. The concept, the plotting, the pacing, and writing are all brilliantly executed. The noir vibe, along with the fungal punk world, gives it a dark and moody edge, and it doesn't fall within a rigid genre on the speculative fiction genre spectrum. A fresh and thoughtful debut. I can't wait for more. 5 stars.
Oh, thank you, Craig.
What would be
that one mentioned the pacing. Thank you even more, Craig.
There you go.
Roller coaster, baby.
Now, how would you pitch Mushroom Blues based on those reviews? Just how would you pitch this to somebody?
A white guy who doesn't understand racism.
Sold.
Yeah, sold. Do you like mushrooms?
Correct.
But I pitch it as a fungal noir police procedural. So if you like police procedural murder mysteries, then this will be right up your alley. I kind of pitch it as True Detective meets Jeff Vandermeer. So if you're kind of into that dark, brooding vibe of True Detective and the sort of the mystery that really affects deeply the characters and the people around, but also with Jeff Vandermeer, where you have weird worlds and, you know, moments that feel a bit kind of like poetic and are capturing the beauty of a world, but also a lot of darkness and a lot of decay, then it'll definitely be for you. If you like fast pace and roller coaster pace and very character-centric story where it follows Henrietta Hoffman as she is investigating the mysterious murder of a fungal child, and she has to team up begrudgingly with mushroom-headed beat cop Koji Nameko to traverse the city of Neokonoko and discover who killed this child and why, and that kind of thrusts them into this path where they come across mushroom-headed gangsters, the corruption of her own police department, you know, people who are struggling, refugees. This is a post-war city, so there's a lot of dark themes and a lot of difficult stuff to deal with, but I like to mix in brightness with the darkness as well. So for sure, if you like police procedurals, if you like murder mysteries, then this one will be for you. If you don't like the glossary, just skip it. That's totally fine. I don't mind.
But don't skip the intro here, because this is the end. Great pitch, Adrian.
So, case file number 42 through 56. No good day ever started with death before coffee. I stood on the shoreline of Spirit Island, gazing upon a lumpy trash bag. It was nestled in an icy bed of seaweed next to a rotting... Now, here's where the fungal words come in.
Mycopaper.
Lantern. I'm going to butcher all of them. A handful of bioluminescent motes floated above the water. Waves lapped against the bag where a large rip revealed a pale patch of hairless skin. pungent saltiness rose up from algae and cold ocean spray, overpowering whatever I was about to find in there. I took out a face mask and put it on NKPD protocol, and no way I would let anything contaminate me.
Gets right to the investigation from the get-go.
Pacing-wise, the murder happens first paragraph.
Yeah. And now, if Michael, now for... I don't know which book you want to pitch, but this is the one we have. So,
we'll do songs.
What do you want to pitch?
He wants to pitch let them whimper again.
Now we'll do songs. Go on.
Right. So for Ascendant here, now would you like to start with the 1 or 5? Do you want to copy Adrian and go 1, 1 then 5?
Oh,
or
start? It's got to be the 1.
Okay.
It's got to be the 1.
Yours, yeah. I don't know what this says, but a lot of your 1-star reviews were very long, so I took the shortest I could. So all the 5-stars and 1-stars had a lot to say.
Like, they were passionately hating it,
so,
which you have to admire to some degree.
You
a
do.
A passionate hater is...
Yeah.
I like it.
You have to put in the enjoyment. Find that vegan one. It's, honestly, it's brilliant.
Was the vegan one very long?
In your own time, at your own leisure.
I will, because I found the shortest one possible. Okay, 1-star review from Yosef. Derivative, boring, interminable. That's it.
Just 3 words.
Sums it up, right? Yeah.
I love it. Throw it in. Interminable.
Interminable.
Oh, so below me.
We totally use that word.
We totally would.
Yeah, yeah.
So I know. Word a day calendar is like, well, there we go.
Word time to use it. Right? Now, here is the 5-star. This is from Philip Bowen Brazelli from Brazil. Philip says, 5 stars, a welcome breath of fresh air. I am giving this book a resounding 5 stars. I don't usually leave reviews, but this book deserves it. I picked it up and literally couldn't put my phone down until I finished it. It grabbed me from the get-go and never let go. And even better, the book left me desperately wanting more, but without that bittersweet feeling I usually get from finishing a book in a series that has yet to be released. All I can say is it amazing job, and I can't wait for the next in the series.
What a lovely review.
It's a good Michael, five star.
How would you like to pitch this book?
Beautiful cover.
Beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I would pitch Songs of Chaos as a sort of timeless, ageless dragon rider epic that anyone can read of all ages. I've got, you know, people, if you loved Pern back in the day, if you blew like this, and if you grew up in Eragon a bit like me, you probably will also get a lot out of this. It's definitely for everyone. Do you know what the tone of a sadness novel? I think is actually a fair cop because there's no graphics swearing, there's no graphic sex, but we still deal with dark and mature topics here and there. We deal with that well, but it's accessible, and it's all about Holt Cook, who is a servant boy. He defies the society he's in to rescue a doomed dragon egg, hatches, and it's a blind dragon, and it's from there on out, it's sort of them against the world. They are outcasts. They are punished for doing the right thing, which I thought was very important. And it's largely their story about how they can maintain being good and heroic despite the dark world and everyone telling them that they're wrong. And there you go. I think I know I could go on and on and on, but big dragon rider epic, timeless classic. A little bit of magic. The magic is a little bit inspired by progression fantasy from Cradle, especially if you like Cradle. There's a good pinch of that in here. I was really inspired by that series and Will White's work. So a bit of a matching together of a Sanderson, a Christopher Parolini, and a Will White.
Great pitch. And this is the first paragraph or so of Ascendant.
Though he was running late, Holt spared a moment when he heard the dragon's roar. Breathing hard, he halted upon the carved servant stairs and craned his neck to look at the beasts. The order hall of the crag dominated the skyline, a spire as sharp as the jagged rocks surrounding it, and swirling around the tower as though a flock of birds were the dragons themselves. A flight of pressure in anticipation for the esteemed visitor expected that afternoon from Rider High Command.
get right to all three of your books when you're pitching too. All the first paragraphs are like, okay, Dragon Rider, craziness, balloons are coming, but sexual, whatever. And then
sexual balloons are incoming.
And the author who did shrooms. So what a pair of three folk we got here. This was a fun. And by the way, Michael, your book looks so tame in comparison to what they have going on. Where yours is just like, boom, you know what you're getting, Dragon Rider. All right, let's go.
Dragon Rider. It's
let's get in here.
Timeless. Coming of age story. Dealing with right and wrong, and then we got Adrian. What if mushroom?
What if a cop investigated a dead child and then hallucinated?
I got a mushroom pitch. I mean, chapter one of my book does feature a guy who's tripping on mushrooms with a cult of naked farmers, and he's on the phone with his current wife, his third wife. And he's tripping out, and it's a fun scene. Oh, she's fucking another man.
Of course. Yes. Of course. Yeah.
But like, since he's tripping, you know, he doesn't really perceive it. So
I will say, I was reading the first chapter of your book, Keith, and it was the most unique experience. I was like, oh my God. The advantage of self-published books too is my favorite book, one of my favorites, Sword of Kaigan, self-published, because you don't have
that
to fit. What's that?
That would never get traditionally
exactly.
Published.
It wouldn't get traditionally published. You have to self-publish it, and I'm so glad you did. So, thank you everybody for this whole conversation. And go check out all their books in the link in the description below. Rich, anything else to sign us off with?
I guess we learned some interesting things about dragons, mushrooms, and balloons. So. Mm-hmm. If you also learned something about balloons, comment down below.
In this conversation about criticism.
Oh yeah, that's right. That's what the topic was.
Of course. And the views, something like that.
Something about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Comment below. Criticize our discussion.
Yes. Yeah. Rate our discussion 1 through 5 stars. Let's see how that goes. All right, everybody.
Thank you very much for coming on, and we'll see you all later.
See you next episode.
Thank you. It was surreal.
Thanks for having us, guys. Bye-bye.
Listen, everyone makes messes. It's just a part of life. And the bigger you live, the bigger the mess, if you know what I mean. That's why you need Fabuloso. With twice the active cleaning ingredients, it just completely takes the drama out of any mess. It smells great while you clean. The only way to describe it is the scent of passion. And once you're done cleaning, it lasts so long. You know, if you make a mess, you can get your home dramatically clean with Fabuloso. No worries.